This is the Voice Overwork podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services. On the podcast today, we take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at philosophies on self-discipline, lessons from history's greatest thinkers on how to start, endure, finish, and achieve. Written by Peter Hollins, narrated by Russell Newton. Chapter 1, Plato and Akrasia. Akrasia is whenever we work against our own best interests. Aristotle claimed we could combat akrasia through self-disciplined action toward our goals, repetition, and being honest with ourselves. Plato claimed we simply needed to avoid finding goodness in bad actions. You know you want to get in shape, and you're finally committed to it, buying an expensive gym membership and laying out a new plan for exactly how you're going to gain strength. Day one and two of your new protocol work well, but on day three, something strange happens. You skip your workout. Despite knowing how badly you want to be better, despite understanding all the benefits on the table and how proud and confident you'd feel if you actually achieved this goal, despite all the dedication and goodwill you began with, you skip your workout and watch YouTube videos instead. What happened? It's a strange part of the human condition when you really think about it. We have what feels like a will to do something, and yet there's something else seemingly acting against us. Some call it plain old temptation, i.e., going for the pleasurable thing in the moment rather than staying the more difficult but more rewarding path. Others would call it laziness, procrastination, weakness, or self-sabotage. Some would suggest that behaving this way means you simply don't want your goals badly enough, because if you did, you'd move mountains to achieve it. It turns out this problem existed long before the modern distraction of YouTube, however. Ancient philosophers tried to understand this phenomenon and ask themselves, why do people act against their own interests? And, seeing as we do, how can we take control and reach the goals that are so important to us? The term akrasia describes this phenomenon and is from the Greek word which means lack of command. Chapter 2. Nietzsche and Will to Power. Friedrich Nietzsche believed we are all born with a will to power, but use it to different ends. Our self-discipline can keep our will to power aligned with our higher goals if we are conscious and mindful of it. We have a responsibility to create our own goals and, in the process, create ourselves. Let's continue and see what other, more modern philosophers have to say about self-discipline and how we can better achieve our dreams. An idea closely related to akrasia is the concept of will, or, more specifically, Nietzsche's will to power. Our goal in this book is to learn as much as we can about self-discipline from as many sources as possible so we can develop the skills and knowledge needed to genuinely improve in life. But let's unwrap this idea a little. What are we really doing when we say, I want to learn the violin, or I'm going to be an entrepreneur? More abstractly, what is actually going on when we decide to do anything? What is it that makes a baby stand up and take its first steps? What makes people want to climb tall mountains? And what compels people to make art, invent, start businesses, have a family, or paint their living rooms green? You can probably think of a million things that you don't care about achieving. While you may have many life goals, there are probably some achievements you're more than happy to forego or simply don't care about. It's not that you couldn't, but rather that you choose not to. What does this tell us about the nature of our desires and actions we take? The idea of a will to power began with philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who explained that there must be some sort of driving force in all human beings that motivated them to do the things they did. This will can be channeled into any purpose. And Chapter 3. Aristotle and self-control. Aristotle believed that temptations and distractions will always exist, but we need to be prepared to resist them with good habits. We can find improvement in every situation by seeking the golden mean, perfect moderation. We've looked at two important factors of human motivation in the previous chapters, namely, A, our innate and malleable drive that Nietzsche called the will to power, and B, that pesky phenomenon called akrasia that threatens to derail our will to power and take us off the path that leads to our goals. It's a fundamental truth that any deliberate transformation requires energy and effort. If we wish to change and develop as people, we need to move from where we are to where we want to be. And that means we have to push against the momentum that keeps us as we are and pull toward what we want but doesn't exist yet. Improvement is seldom easy. When you're learning something new, working hard toward a goal, or trying to gain mastery over something, you need self-control to consistently steer you in the right direction. Like a sailboat on the ocean, every gust of wind and wave threatens to push it off course, but it's up to your self-discipline and control to steer it where you want it to go. We already briefly discussed Aristotle's view on self-discipline in a previous chapter. For him, as it was for many of his contemporaries, rationality and willpower could be undermined by laziness, uncontrolled emotions, and poor judgment. In the same way as a heavy object can be moved if one has strengthened their muscles adequately enough to lift it, Aristotle fundamentally believed that a sufficiently strong will could achieve other more abstract goals. Self-control, as Aristotle defined it, is not very different from what we... Chapter 4, Aristippus and Ethical Hedonism. Pure hedonism is an enemy of self-discipline, but we can still seek our own pleasure while taking responsibility for our long-term goals, according to Aristippus. We can be ethical hedonists by making new definitions for both pain and pleasure. You've set yourself a goal, and you know what you need to do to get there. Then, a temptation comes along, as it always does. Junk food, lounging around in front of the TV, mindless social media use, smoking, drinking, all the other alluring bad habits. But what is it about these things really that draw us in? That's simple. They feel good. We seek them out and succumb to their call because it feels pleasurable to do so. This is why any discussion about self-discipline needs to seriously consider the role of pleasure and what it means for our plans to be and do more. In reading some of the self-control ideology above, you may have once or twice recoiled, thinking, well, this doesn't sound like much fun. The trouble with the virtuous life is that it can seem so joyless and boring. Of course cake wins out over a healthy meal, and sleeping in wins out over going to the gym. It just feels better. And isn't that what life is about, feeling good? Isn't a life that's all hard work and no enjoyment really no life at all? It turns out this question has fueled plenty of metaphysical debate, primarily in the philosophical position called hedonism. Often assumed to mean seek pleasure above all else, hedonism is actually a complex concept with many subtleties and modern variations. It says that pleasure is the moral imperative of a human being, and the highest and, in fact, only universal good, while pain is an evil to be avoided. Chapter 5, Freud and Subconscious Motivators. Freud believed that people pushed threatening thoughts and feelings out of awareness, but that these could still work unconsciously to affect behavior. In being honest with ourselves, however, we can bring this material back into the conscious mind and regain self-discipline and control. The idea confounded Plato. How could it be that a person could rashly know the right thing to do but choose something else? For many ancient Greek philosophers, human rationality and reason were esteemed above all else, so they sometimes had real trouble explaining seemingly irrational behavior. Saying you desire A, but then choosing B certainly seems to be illogical. But what if there was some third hidden variable influencing things? What if you were in fact saying you wanted B, only you did so without knowing that you did? Modern psychology has, in effect, taken over from the ancient philosophers in trying to understand the motivations and drivers of human behavior, and one of its biggest developments was to establish the theory of the unconscious mind. Founded and championed primarily by Sigmund Freud in the Victorian era, the idea was that the mind itself had a topology, i.e., not all regions were the same, and some were hidden in the darkness out of conscious awareness. In the unconscious mind, Freud argued, we store all sorts of thoughts, motivations, feelings, memories, and urges that have tangible influences on our daily lives, although without us having the slightest awareness of them. Jung, a theorist influenced partly by Freud, summed it up by saying, "Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life, and you will call it fate." Freud believed that most of the mind was unconscious, akin to the biggest portion of an iceberg that's actually lying invisibly under. Chapter 6, B.F. Skinner and Behaviorism. B.F. Skinner believed that our behavior is heavily influenced by the consequences of that behavior, which come from our interactions with our environment. If we seek to alter our behavior, we need to look at making changes to our environment and how we engage with it. Psychologist B.F. Skinner is primarily associated with the behaviorist school in psychology. Starting in the early 1900s, Skinner's view could not have been more different from Freud's vision of a person being unconsciously driven by powerful but hidden inner drives. From the behaviorist perspective, what humans being did was largely down to one thing, the environment. The idea was that the likelihood of a behavior occurring came down to the perceived consequences of that behavior. If you were punished every time you did X, for example, you would soon stop doing X. In a nutshell, this is what Skinner called operant conditioning, and if you know anything about training dogs or getting toddlers to keep quiet, you're probably already very familiar with its principles. Conditioning is a process of interaction with the environment, which leads to learned behavior. Another way of putting it is to say that all behaviors are learned responses to the environment. If I consistently praise a small child for eating all their vegetables, I'm providing an environmental stimulus that reinforces a certain behavior, i.e., them eating their vegetables. That's the theory, anyway. We make associations between our behavior and its consequences, and, according to behaviorist thought, this is how we learn to continue some behaviors and stop others. Those behaviors that are reinforced persist and become stronger, while those that aren't rewarded or are even actively discouraged will die away with time. Behavior can be shaped by either positive or negative reinforcement. A positive reinforcement is a... Chapter 7. Kaizen. The philosophy of Kaizen teaches us that improvements come from gradual, consistent changes. Kaizen is about taking actions that add value and cutting down on waste and inefficiency. It's also about never making excuses. Of course, it's not just Western philosophers who have something to say about self-discipline. Cultures all around the world have their unique take on the issue. In Japan, one perspective is called Kaizen, where Kai is the symbol for change, and Zen, the symbol for good. The symbols together simply mean change for good. In the Kaizen philosophy, the best kind of improvement is slow and steady. Because Kaizen puts such an emphasis on order, discipline, and frugality, it's a favorite framework amongst entrepreneurs and business managers. Its principles have been used in everything from software development to improving manufacturing processes. But we can use the same ideas to improve our own personal self-discipline efforts. The idea is not so much that there is some grand goal waiting on the horizon that you're rushing toward and can declare yourself finished when you reach it. Rather, it's a focus on process rather than outcome. What matters is continuous, incremental improvements in every aspect of a process as a way of life. In business lore, Kaizen is about fine-tuning manufacturing, management, and logistics processes. But for our purposes, we'll be looking at how we can use Kaizen on personal goals. The Japanese cultural spirit holds that everyone in society has a valuable role to play, no matter if they're a housewife or businessman, CEO or janitor, and they can function in this role with ever-increasing perfection and efficiency. Kaizen gained popularity in post-World War II Japan when Toyota... Chapter 8. Marcus Aurelius and Stoicism. The Stoics were all about finding your own personal power within and creating a life of purpose, wisdom, and courage. For them, self-discipline was essential for a good life. It's the thing that keeps you going through adversity and teaches you to turn challenge into mastery and wisdom. Though modern analytical philosophy is obscure and can seem impenetrable to the layperson, The ancient Greeks were very much concerned with philosophy as a means of uncovering humankind's true purpose in a practical way. They were interested in what was good, moral, and useful. They wanted to understand the best way a person ought to conduct themselves through life. Stoicism was one school of thought that was so successful in outlining these principles, thus, it's no surprise it's still loved and revered today. Though the word Stoic now has certain connotations, i.e., denoting something bare, joyless, or fatalistic, this worldview is, in fact, a very realistic, empowering one that offers real wisdom for living a meaningful life. The Stoics lived in a very different world. They looked around and saw that adversity, tragedy, and suffering were an inevitable part of life, and knew that a mature philosophy had to do better than merely pretend such things didn't exist. There's a well-known Christian prayer that says, "God, grant me the serenity to accept what I cannot change, the courage to change what I cannot accept, and the wisdom to know the difference." It's a sentiment that could have been written by famous Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, one of the best-known Stoic writers. For these philosophers, life was tough, and there was no getting around it. There's no point in blaming others, getting despondent, or crumbling, though. Rather, if we hope... This has been Philosophies on Self-Discipline, Lessons from History's Greatest Thinkers on How to Start, Endure, Finish, and Achieve. Written by Peter Hollins, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2020 by Peter Hollins. Production copyright by Peter Hollins. To learn more about today's author or book, please visit Amazon.com or Audible.com. Show notes and further information can be found at RussellEricNewton.com. With a collection of trivia, research, news stories, and knowledge from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Over Work podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.